Welcome to this week's episode of Nevada Backcountry on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Big thank you to our show sponsors, Rightful Liberty Arms, Shooting Performance Institute, Truck Envy, and Battleborn Tree Service. And I actually think Mike from Battleborn is out with a buddy of his that has a 16 bull tag.
Ooh.
Which is where Mike shot that 389 monster a couple years back. So I think those fellas are going to do A-okay.
Oh, I think they'll do fine. They're going to probably get up and table or something. Or
yeah, Mike's got a spot in there. But here's the, if you want to just be green with jealous rage, the friend of Mike's that has this tag, last year was his first archery tag, and he killed that like knocking on 170 inch buck that my dad helped them on.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. So
and
goes
now he's got
and now he's tag. Got a bull tag in 16 with Mike. Some people, man.
Well, yeah, but you know that kind of luck runs out eventually. You can only pull so many tags before you go into a dry spell.
I mean, once, and not just pulling tags, but hunts. But
yeah. Well, hunts,
like
yeah.
Being successful.
Yeah.
We've talked about it before. Yeah. I was on a hot streak for about 5 or 6 years. Yeah. I thought, man, I have arrived.
Yeah, exactly. I've done the same thing. I've had a couple years. I've filled every tag, and I was like, dude, I'm the king.
I know what I'm doing.
I know what I'm doing. I got this figured out now. And then
peaks and valleys.
You betcha, man. Then there's that year you don't get anything, and then it kind of dries out, and then,
yep.
Yeah. Just gotta take it with a happy face.
Roll with the punches.
Roll with it. But that's awesome, man.
Yeah.
Eventually he'll get into that cycle where he's in the waiting period for literally everything.
Yep.
And then the rest of us can pull tags.
Bingo. I'm looking. My day in the sun is coming.
Yes, it is.
Let's talk about fire stuff. Or not fire stuff, but reseeding stuff.
Yeah.
So the Hawk fire. I've actually got a gimpy GSP at my house right now. Friends, I think they're at a family member's house right now. They may be staying at our place. So we had friends affected by it.
Yeah.
What is the plan when this stuff happens? What does the process look like to start? We had the Bug Fire, Fred Mountain, Stallion, now the Hawk Fire, all this.
That's just in this area. I mean, we've got that big fire up near Wells. We've got that fire up in Via right now that's roasting a bunch of stuff. I mean, there's a lot of fires going on. So
yes.
Different groups of individuals will meet up, collaborate with, Fish and Wildlife Service, Forest, U.S. Forest Service, Nevada Division of Forestry, BLM, Department of Ag, kind of get together and they'll start formulating technically like plans.
Right.
Based on these particular fires, where they are geographically and all of that, start developing, specific seed mixes that they need to start acquiring.
Rehab plans.
Yeah, rehab plans.
Which is where I was, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, you got to go in, you'll have to map the area, because some of these areas are, like this particular fire went from the tops of Peavine all the way down to the valleys.
Yep.
So you're going to different areas of different seed mixes. You're not going to seed like the Bug Fire's 140,000 acres or something. You're not doing that in a year. Plus, you've got the other fires that are right on our border. And we work with, Idaho and Oregon and stuff on some of those other fires that have torched 250,000 acres right now. So those are multiple years of potential seeding. And, a lot of that, you may not seed the whole bloody thing.
Right.
You're going to try to do the best you can. But right now, it's just one of those things where a lot of stuff going on, a lot of pieces of the puzzle are moving and coordinating with different groups on approaches.
So phase one is basically like the coordination between different agencies. And you said mapping.
Yeah. So you got to map what burnt. So you'll have to get like some LIDAR or what have you and get out and determine like what is burnt. What kind of acreage are we looking at? What's the potential of how many acres do we think we can actually rehab?
Okay.
So there's a lot of that going on. And then you go into like potential seed mixes or approaches. Are you going to do some groundwork? Are you going to do it in a helicopter? Are you going to do it in ATVs? There's a lot of coordination got to go on. And then what areas would be so like low hanging fruit? What can we get to that's not going to be really insane that we can get to? Low hanging fruit stuff, some of this lower canyon stuff or what have you.
Okay.
And then the tougher stuff can be addressed as well.
I learned this from Chris Costin, Muley Fanatic Foundation, and now TRCP. You guys have to, I mean, once it burns, and I say you guys, I'm using that like writ large.
All the NGOs that are involved, universities and everybody else that wants to help out. Yeah, volunteer bases.
So once it's burned and everything's blackened and the mapping's done, coordination's done, planning's done, step one is almost like an herbicide treatment or like a pre-emergent.
Yeah, kind of like a pre-emergent herbicide. Some of that is also if it's in, you know, particular forested areas, you're going in and leaving some downed material for wildlife and for small mammals and stuff. And then removing some stuff that may, you know, just might be too much of a concentration. Kind of like the fire that happened out here on Mount Rose year before.
Which one?
The one that started in Davis Creek Park.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, right now they're in there right now. They're removing trees. They're going in there and cleaning that all up and getting that all dialed in. And then, you know, that's part of a phase. They're going in, cleaning stuff up, leaving some stuff, dropping some things and leaving them down, moving other parts out, depending, again, where the fire is, how it is, access to certain areas. You know, that comes in a bunch of phases. But yeah, you're going to put down an herbicide or a pre-emergent, stuff like that, trying to decrease the potential of like some of our invasives, like cheatgrass and
thistle
stuff. I mean, that's going to come in no matter what. That's going to happen. There's nothing we can do about that. Just trying to do the best you can to eliminate, you know, like a full-blown cheatgrass mosaic across 100,000 acres.
And I know I'm asking these situation-dependent questions, but in general, like, would you, let's say this Hawk fire, take that one. You would say, like, okay, the herbicide goes down, pre-emergent goes down, you wait a winter, and then you reseed? Or what's the timeline between double nuking it and then trying to establish something?
Well, so they'll put the pre-emergent stuff down, then you got to wait a certain period of time,
right?
You know, to let that stuff settle and then kind of neutralize. And then you generally want to reseed, put your seed and stuff down right before a weather event or winter or something, so that that seed that you're laying down isn't blown across the valley by big winds or eaten by rodents and small mammals and birds and whatever. When that weather comes in, you get the snow on it or rain or whatever, that's the seed will then settle into the soils.
Right.
And give it a much higher probability of germinating than if you just laid it out there.
Like,
yeah, in the middle of summer, you lay it out there dry. For one, the heat and everything's going to completely destroy it. And then you get these winds, and next thing you know, everything's growing in a big old rock pile that's, you know, 800 yards away.
It does no good.
But usually, you want to wait a certain amount of time, depending on the type of herbicide you use or pre-emergent you use and stuff. You know, they all have a time frame for it to be, you're able to now plant.
Okay.
Basically. So that could be anywhere from 60 days to several months.
Would I be too optimistic to think that come spring, I could be looking at native stuff greening up on pea vine? Would spring be too soon?
No, not necessarily. As long as we get some moisture, precip.
Right.
You know, there's going to be the whole natural regeneration of its own. You know, a lot of time fires cause seed pods to pop, cause things to germinate on their own. How nature takes care of itself.
Right.
So you're going to have some of that natural recruitment. Will it be enough to turn the place back to how it was? Probably not, especially with all the invasives we've seemed to have acquired. But no, you wouldn't be unheard of.
Okay.
Like I said, as long as we get some decent precip or at least a fair amount.
You and I were talking about that.
Super duper ninja, whatever they're calling it, Mega Nino or something we're supposed to have. Super moist, wet winter.
See, I thought we were going into a drought cycle, and then I think I told you, I got a rambling yarn thumbtacks on the wall type of email connecting a bunch of environmental dots about something about we're supposed to get just slammed this winter.
Yeah, I must have got the same one, because I was reading some post, this thing I got, and I was like, and I'd never heard of this like super Nino thing. Is this AI trying to jack me up or something? But it showed these models how this is coming down and right. this is going to come in. And if they hit at the right time, we're going to end up with like biblical waterfall.
80
and
feet
certain,
of snow.
You know, just crazy stuff, you know. But I'm like, huh, we went from going into a drought cycle to we may all need to buy boats.
Yeah, exactly. You know? When I sat through that Wildlife Commission thing, listening to the environmental science kid, I was like, or I say kid, good grief, I'm starting to sound like my dad.
He's like 38.
Yeah, he's my age. Yeah. I sat through that and I went, oh man, this is going to be terrible. It's, you know, we're entering this epic drought. And then I got that email and I'm trying to connect the dots in it. And I went, oh wait, maybe not. Maybe it'll be a good winter. We're going to end on that note. When we come back, we'll touch a little more on the recent fires in the area and rehab projects. We'll also get into a deer hunt Dave was just on, and then we'll wrap up with a cluster F of a public land hunting story. Do not go anywhere. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Welcome back to Nevada Backcountry on this Sunday, only on 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. Thank you to Rightful Liberty Arms, Shooting Performance Institute, Truck Envy, and Battle Born Tree Service for sponsoring the show. We got cut off at the end there, Dave. Let's jump right back into, you were saying something about the drought stuff in Nevada as we started to wrap up.
Yeah, you know how Nevada's super unique. And I just say that because I'm from Nevada and this is where I've lived most of my life, but I'm sure other states exhibit this as well. But, you know, you could be here in Reno, Sparks, this western side,
right,
and not see rain for months.
Oh, yeah.
And you're
yeah.
thinking, oh my God, the entire state's going to burn, what have you. Then go to central Nevada, the Monitors, you know, the Diamonds, some of those ranges there. Example, this year, we're out there because we had tags out there hunting. We're out there in the end of July, beginning of August, and everything is lush and green.
Yeah.
The creeks are running really well. Some areas are nice and muddy because they had been getting a phenomenal winter and just truckloads of water.
Well, they just came off a bunch of those monsoons.
Exactly.
Too.
Yeah. Well, when Pat and I were out there scouting, and we got caught in one of those. Like, you just see the black
sideways
cloud.
Rain.
Oh, yeah. And you can't see in front of you. And then next thing you know, the trail you're on or the ATV trail you're on to get out of the canyon is now a creek.
Right.
And you're just like, oh, crud. We need to get out of here, like, now.
Meanwhile, we're sitting here in Reno watching the Hawk Fire rip.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And it's 100 degrees out, and we're out there, it's, you know, 75. And that happens, that northeast part of the state gets a lot of can, the Jarbidge area.
Yeah.
So it's really, I mean, it's just so, like, hit
it's
or
a
miss.
Huge state.
Yeah.
You know, when you hear about these storms in New England, and you think, like, oh, okay, Connecticut's flooding or whatever.
New York. I mean, these places...
It's a postage stamp compared to Nevada where, it's such a huge state. Vegas could be in the most epic drought of all time.
Yeah.
And I could be skiing into July up here.
Exactly. you know, and that is so true because a lot of folks don't get that. Just don't understand. Like, how can one part of your state be dry and the other part be under 3 feet of snow? I'm like, it's the West.
Nevada. Yeah.
It's the freaking West.
Giant state, lots of mountains. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you think of California, you got elevation of zero. All the way to the elevation of 12,000 feet.
What's Whitney? 14 something.
Yeah. 14 something. 14
sea
something.
Level to 14 something.
Yeah. So in 250 miles.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Anyway, so yeah.
It's, I mean, not it's, all doom and gloom. If we get a wet winter, then hopefully this Mega Nino, Super Nino, whatever the heck it is.
Super Ninja Nino or something. Yeah. But like going back to the seeding thing, when you start picking seed or gathering seed, you know, certain seeds have certain viabilities. They have to be planted or at least seeded by a certain amount of time or the seed starts losing its viability for germination. So that's another part of the equation is making sure that you're collecting the seed. And then, you know, you've got about 24 hours to 48 hours before you know that there's going to be like a weather event, a moisture event, snow, freeze, something like that, to try it. That's your best time frame to get that seed on the ground. Let it get on the ground, then let that weather event come in. That's your optimum thing. So it's that timing thing of like, okay, we've got this seed. We can't let it sit for the next 6 months because two thirds of this seed that cost us tens of thousands of dollars is going to be garbage.
So the bag of Scott that's been sitting at Home Depot for 9 months isn't exactly the best option?
It probably is not your best option. If you're using that to like reseed your dog's piss patches.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably not.
Probably not. Best. But it's 50% off,
it's
Dave.
50, yeah, it's 50% off. And if I buy one bag, I get the second one for free.
Exactly.
You know, your best bet is to go to the neighbor.
And just take and a patch
night,
of sod.
At night, cut a patch of his sod out and pull it out and just...
You know, I saw somebody laying sod in the neighborhood. That's not a bad idea. So, hey, I will give kudos.
I just said that. It wasn't me.
Yeah, we know what. I'll give kudos to the department, whoever did the project in the snowstorms.
Yes.
I was up there with Cynthia looking for sheep, and that plateau up top and all the quakies up there and everything, it's minimal cheatgrass. Yeah. Minimal thistle, tons of the Indian rice grass stuff. Yeah. I mean, it looks great up there versus like we talked about that Carson fire.
Yeah.
Where seeding didn't take and it still looks like crap, quite frankly.
Yeah, in some areas it really does because that was just, you know, laying seed, not getting enough precip, and then that's it. It just
didn't take.
Doesn't take. It's a real magic show sometimes trying to get those variables to match up so that your outcome is like, all right, we got our native stuff back. Or, that cheatgrass wasn't there before.
Exactly.
You know, cheat
it's nothing but
thistle.
Russian thistle.
Russian thistle. So, yeah.
You mentioned a deer tag recently.
I did.
We got a little bit of time left on this segment, and then we'll get into it more on the next segment. First time bow hunter you were out with?
He's gone on a bow hunter tube in the past.
For successful bow hunt?
No, this was his first successful.
Gotcha.
Yeah, this was his first successful. And I'd like to get him on the show, John, and get him on here. And I've already talked to him about it. And he said, oh, that'd be kind of cool. Just to pick his brain as a...
What he went through.
Yeah, what he went through. Like emotions, like all this kind of stuff. Because when he first started... he was having just a hard time just like locating animals. And then when he did, it was like, okay, now what do I do?
Like, right.
I mean, how do I approach it? What's the stalk supposed to look like? So there's a lot of things that were not matching up. So he was struggling, especially this year.
Was he out there by himself before?
He was out there for, I think, 4 or 5 days before I got there. And he had only seen like two forkies and a spike and he was just, it was hard. He was having a hard time. So threw him in the machine and got him up on top and into some better country, got up high, and we spotted a nice bachelor group of deer, and we just kind of focused on them for a few days for the time that we were up there. And the last morning, he was like, well, why don't we just wake up? We'll just pack up and just get out of here. I'm good. You know,
hold on, back up. So you guys find the deer.
Yeah.
Had he gone on stalks yet?
He had gone on one short stalk.
Okay.
And the animals, I don't know if they sensed him or just moved on, but
sometimes they have that sixth sense.
Yes. And they just buggered out.
Okay.
And other than that, he'd just been cruising around just trying to find animals and just struggling. You know, this was Saturday, and we had met a really cool guy who had been also hunting those same deer.
Oh, okay.
And he was coming off the hill, and we ran into him, and this was Saturday. Like, we were heading back to camp. It was dark. And he was like, oh, man, I've been out here for 5 days. I'm going into town. I need a shower. I need to, like, a bed.
Gotta hit the reset button.
Yeah, you know. So I probably won't be out here tomorrow morning. Maybe tomorrow evening I'll come back out and I'll stay a couple more days. So we got to talking, and he's like, yeah, I know those deer up on that one canyon, you know. So, yeah, have at it. We were like, okay, well, it's up to John. You know, I'm here to help him. I mean, I've got a tag too, but my focus was getting him his first deer. I just think that would be super cool.
You're such a good guy, Dave. Yeah.
So, I said, okay. So we went up on Sunday. I said, let's hunt the morning. Let's just do this.
Right.
So we went up there and we're cruising up and boom, there they are right on the ridge in this little patch of trees, just right on the edge of the trees. So we went
What time of morning was this?
Oh, this was like 6. Like,
okay,
spotted them right at sunup. We're like, boom.
So moving to their beds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Feeding.
Well, they were just feeding.
Okay.
And then there was a spring down the canyon from them. So we said, you know, okay, so this can be good. Ran up the canyon a ways And John was like, okay, now what do I do from here? So I kind of gave him a route, like, okay, we know that those deer are feeding on the other side of that lone tree in between the big patch of trees, and then there's a big gap. Then there's those two big trees, and then, you know, I'm explaining this to him, but then there's one tree right in the middle. That's the tree I want you to get to. They're right below that tree feeding in that little pocket there.
Right.
So we went around the mountain.
At that time of morning, too, they're probably going to be on the hoof for another hour and a half
easy.
Or so.
Oh,
two hours.
Yeah. Just checking the thermals. They're like, okay. Right. Generally, once it starts warming up, that breeze is going to come up the mountain on them.
Yep.
So if we got to get on the backside. So we got over there, and I kind of gave them a route, like, okay, go to this and then go to this and work your way. Keep the tree line in their way in case they do pop up on the ridge.
Right.
You're still hidden behind these particular trees that were. So he did it. I went all the way back around and got on the far ridge right above the spring thinking, okay, well, if he blows them out and they come down to the spring, I just slide down, you know, about 100 yards.
You had your
here.
Bow and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And
Yeah.
Okay.
I've learned over the years. I don't even go take a pee without my bow.
Yeah, that's a good call.
So I had a plan as well. It's okay. And eventually he gets up there and I can see him kind of moving from tree to tree. And I was like, okay, cool. He's got this. This looks good. He gets up there. He gets to the double tree. And all of a sudden these deer are just like staring him down.
Perfect. Let's stop right there.
All right.
We're going to end with John being eyeballed by a bachelor group of bucks. Do not go anywhere. The rest of the story coming up after the break. Welcome back to Nevada Backcountry. If you miss a segment of the show, you can always go to 991fmtalk.com, click on the podcast tab. All past episodes are available there. And I'll rattle off the show sponsors at the end because we left on a cliffhanger. You're on this deer hunt. You guys find this group of deer.
Yeah.
You're set up on a spring watching your friend John.
Yeah, I'm about 100 yards above the spring in case they do come over. I can slide down. I figured out my little route down to it, and I'd have, I don't know, like a 40-yard shot.
Perfect,
to the spring.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I'm set. I'm good.
Yeah.
So I'm watching. He gets to this double tree that I said, okay, get to that. Evaluate where you are. Look where the deer are and such, and then work your way to that tree that's solo tree in between you and the large tree outcropping. So he gets there, and he wasn't there 10 seconds. And all of a sudden, like, they were in a Broadway show, man. They just, every single one of them in just synchronized movement, staring right at those trees. And I'm like, oh,
he's
crud. He's
blown.
Busted.
Yeah.
He's busted. So they're sitting there staring. And at this point in time, they're only.
How far away are you?
From me to them?
Yeah. From you to where John is, like.
Probably 500 or 600 yards.
Okay.
Yeah. So the deer are probably 40-ish yards from John right now.
Gotcha.
So they start walking off. And I was like, oh, freaking A.
Yeah.
This sucks.
Poor guy.
Yeah. So then this one nice fork and horn that's kind of seems to be like the one in charge. Even though there was this really wicked looking 3x3, heavy antlered 3x3.
I love big threes.
Yeah, The kicker was on his left side, on his driver's side. At first when I saw him, I thought he's got like a branch or something stuck in his antlers. Something's not right. He looks weird. It was like a 3/4 inch straight as an arrow dowel that's probably 15 to 18 inches long.
Yeah.
Sticking at a 45 degree angle off of the main beam, which turned him into like a 36 inch deer. Just sticking straight out of his head.
Yeah.
I was like, really looked at him tight when we got further up close to him. And I was like, that is the freakiest thing. That's the one I would have wanted.
Right.
But anyway, so they're walking off. This one fork and horn, really good size, nice mature fork and horn, stops, turns around, looks at the trees, and then starts walking back to the tree. And he just brings the rest of them. And I was like, oh, what in the world
Perfect.
Is happening here?
Yeah.
So they came
Those
back.
Those don't get served up too
no,
often.
And this,
yeah.
The crazy thing was is that happened 3 times.
Okay.
So they came back. Him and his little buddy is like a spike. They walk almost to like 15 yards to where John is. He's frozen and he's looking up the mountain. I'm like, what in the world are you doing? They're on the other side of the tree. Like, I'm freaking out here.
Yeah,
I'm like,
yeah.
Why are you not looking down the hill? And like, you're looking up the hill.
Right.
What are you doing? They walk off again. They're just staring into this tree. So that happens, and then John slowly gets a gap, and he moves to that middle tree where I told him, that's where you're going to shoot your deer.
Okay.
So he gets there, standing there. They all come back, and now they're all staring at that tree.
The one that he's at,
now
or that, the one
now
that...
the one that he's in the middle tree by the solo tree, and now they're focused on that one because he's like rummaging around there, and I'm like, what in the heck are you doing?
Yeah.
And he keeps looking up the hill, like into the bigger trees, and I'm like, they do this like three times, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and I'm thinking, oh, they want water.
Oh, he's in between them and water.
He's in between them and the water.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm thinking, oh, man, they want to come down to this spring.
I might get lucky here.
Yeah, so on the fourth try, he finally turns around, and he's got the deer. He's like, okay, he's focused. He's on his knees. He's got his bow in front of him. He's ready to rock and roll. And finally, that Forkinhorn, the group leader,
yeah,
they walked almost all the way to the other end of the tree line, and I thought, okay, they're gone this time. That darn Forkinhorn, man, all of a sudden he stops, he turns back around, looks at the trees, and starts walking back. And
absolutely,
I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
And this time he was like, screw it, man. I don't care what's in that tree. I'm going. And so there was a tree right below John, which was at 40 yards, he said. And I'm from where I'm at, I'm like, man, if they go in between him and the tree, that deer's getting an arrow.
Right.
But if it goes on the other side of that tree, John's not going to take the shot because he wasn't comfortable at that distance.
Okay.
That freaking deer just beelined it and went right in between and stopped for a second, and then that was it. I saw the shot, you know, the blood spot on the side, and that deer didn't go, I would say, maybe 20 yards and just tumbled over.
Just perfect behind the shoulder. And
he shot high in the, but he was, I mean, it was a downhill shot.
Oh, okay.
So he shot pretty high on the chest, on the entrance side.
Right.
But on the other
side, it came out
right in the middle of the chest.
Oh, good for him.
And that was it. And then, you know, just good times after that.
You guys start hooping and hollering across the canyon.
And just making a big scene and the whole bit. And interesting part was, is say if I was with him, if we had stalked up there together, which I told him, we're not doing that. There's no reason to.
Right.
It's double the noise, double the bodies. I mean, everything else, just go. But if I had, those other deer just stood there.
Oh, and couldn't figure out.
They just stood there.
Yeah, yeah.
The one deer got hit, you know, shot in the chest, runs off, falls over, done. That was it. So the rest of them are like,
huh,
what is that moron doing?
Yeah.
Like they stood there, and I'm like, oh, man, if I was up there,
yeah,
I could have shot that cool,
weird looking one,
3x whatever in the world that thing was. But, you know, I was so happy for John. I mean, it was my focus. It happened. I got him the deer, or he got the deer, but
yeah,
I was there to help him.
You were able to meaningfully contribute.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
I contributed what knowledge I had on how to do it, and he executed it. It was up to him to execute it, and
yeah,
it's up to him to shoot. Like they say, you know, a lot of these guides will tell you, I'll give you the opportunity, but I can't guarantee you the animal. I can give you an opportunity. And he was given the opportunity, and he just laced it.
Afterwards, did you talk to him about the back and forth movement of the deer? And was he watching all that, or was he looking in a different direction?
So the reason he was looking in the other direction was he had a doe bedded right above him, like 15 yards. So he was trying not to spook the doe while moving into position. And I was like, oh, because I was like, I was wondering why you had your back to the deer and your, he's like, I was watching the doe that was bedded.
Yes.
And she was watching the deer that were feeding. And I'm like, oh, dang, you put a whole nother level of difficulty on this program, and you freaking nailed it.
Pulled it off.
Freaking nailed it. So.
Yeah, get him on the show, Dave. I will tell you, this is a perfect example. You and I have hunted together, and you know how I feel about that, like, back and forth communication nonstop on a stalker. Like, I don't like it. I don't want my phone vibrating. None of that stuff. I can't stand it. And there's that, some people have that inability to realize that what you see from your perspective as the guy with the bow in your hands is not always what the person from across a canyon can see. And so that would be a perfect example of something, you know, if you were not Dave Catalano and you're going, I got a call, he doesn't see, and it's like he knew what was going on in his little his piece of the pie.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly, because when to go off of that, when I got up there to where he was, he probably didn't see the deer, like he even said, he didn't see the deer when they would go back and forth and back. Like when they were 15 yards from him, there was a big bush, like a buck brush.
Yeah.
The two of them were standing there, no more than 15 yards. Like 15 yards was long.
Oh,
just
okay.
Standing like right there at the tree that he was at. Yeah. And I'm like, how's he not see this? What's going on? Yeah. He goes, I couldn't see through the tree. Yeah. So I had to go around the side of the tree to see because the tree was so thick. I couldn't see. I said, yeah, because they were right on the other side of the tree, dude.
Think about your elk hunt, Dave.
Oh, yeah.
We were only at one point like 70 yards apart.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking I'm going to get run over by this bull that's standing broadside to where I think you are. I mean, 70 yards, 60 yards apart, and we might as well have been in different worlds.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm laying there like, man, any second now, I'm going to see this thing get zipped, and then it's going to run me over and kill me.
Yeah.
Like, I hope, okay.
And I can't even see it.
And you didn't even see him.
I didn't even see him. I mean, he was 40 yards from me, but it was thick enough brush and trees.
Angle of the slope, all that.
And that's how it was for him. It was such an angle. From where I was sitting, I'm like, how does he not see all these deer? Every single one of those is within 35, 40
yards. Come on, man, kill it.
Yeah. That's where you've got to be patient. And, you know, trust me, there was a time I'm like, should I buzz him? Should I try to shoot him a text or something? I'm like, no, I'm just letting this roll because, I don't know.
Guy on the ground has the call. Yeah.
I'm leaving that alone. I'm just going to watch this out.
Yeah.
So, and it all worked out great. And we got the animal out of there, got it back to camp, and just kind of sat and we went through the processing together and the whole bit and got it in the coolers. And
it was hard horned.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was. So that told me one thing is that he was an older deer. So when I checked his jaw and everything, I'm like, oh, dude, this guy's like 4 or 5 years old. But he was a really nice fork and horn. He'll just never going to be anything but a fork and horn.
That's it.
But yeah, he was hard horned. And the other ones in the group, there were a total of 6. And the big 3-point wicked dowel kicker thing, he was full velvet.
Oh, okay.
Heavy, full velvet. You can see it glistening in the sun. And just, man, I would have chased him down with a spork. It would have been so cool. Such a neat thing.
Man, awesome. I am jealous that you got to be out there for that, Dave. I hear the music, so we have got to go to a quick break. Do not go anywhere. Stay tuned to 99.1 and 92.3 FM Talk. And thank you to Shooting Performance Institute, Rifle Liberty Arms, Battleborn Tree Service, and Truck Envy for sponsoring Nevada Backcountry. Final segment of Nevada Backcountry on this Sunday. Thank you. All you take time out of your Sunday to tune in to me and Dave and send us messages. Say hey to us when you recognize us out and about. Now let's switch gears and talk about a different type of hunt, an elk hunt. I'm going to try to make this as brief as possible. It's kind of a long story, but interesting article that came out on Wednesday. Came out on Wednesday. And I think I told you, Dave, having worked in the industry and then been around, you know, the trade shows, conventions and stuff, I've run into people in the hunting industry that you meet them and you're like, yeah, if this guy pops up on a poaching story someday, I 100% think he did it.
Yeah.
And then there are a handful of people that you meet in the industry. In my few limited interactions with Andrew McKean from Outdoor Life, he has always struck me as a really stand-up, honest individual, and he is at the center of this story. So I'll set the lay of the land real quick, and then Dave and I will discuss. He and I think it was 4 or 5 friends have elk tags in this unit. They know that there is a parcel of landlocked BLM land. So for shiggles, they decide to rent a helicopter or not, you know,
to charter it.
Charter a helicopter. So a helicopter takes them into this landlocked parcel. And with everything going on in the world right now, as far as the corner crossing and all that stuff, I believe he's still the editor at Outdoor Life. He thinks, hey, this is going to make for a great story. Here's what we did to get into this landlocked parcel and kill some bulls. So they get in there. They're aware of some of the private land boundaries around this area.
Yeah, because they're using onyx, right?
Correct.
Yeah, yep, so they're correct. Using onyx.
And as I learned reading this article, onyx actually, somewhere in the fine print, there's a disclaimer that they, I think they call it like a 15-yard accuracy on property boundaries.
Oh,
so
okay.
Accurate to within, I don't think I'm wrong. Someone out there, if you hear this and it's a different number, by all means, send us a text, 775-884-9910, and correct me. But I believe it's a 15-yard accuracy rule on property boundaries. They're aware of all this. First guy that gets his elk down, the rancher, actually, the private parcel next to this area they're hunting, he actually steals the bull. The bull runs and dies, and the rancher steals it. The rancher was then charged with that and had to give everything back and I think received a fine. That's kind of putting the cart before the horse here. Anyway, fast forward like a week or so, they're still in there hunting. Andrew has an opportunity at a bull. They're watching it from this knob. He's aware that there's a spring that's on BLM land. And then they know there's a little corner of private land that kind of juts in near this spring. So they watch these bachelor group of bulls kind of work through. They cut across the private and they're heading like towards this spring. They decide to slip down, he and one other guy. They go down. Well, the bull's standing right there when they come around this knob. Heat of the moment, not thinking to check the map again or anything. Pile drives it. It's a rifle hunt, and the bull, I guess, was at like 30 yards.
Oh, geez.
So he just smashes this thing. It runs a little ways downhill and down this kind of coulee and dies. I don't think I'm wrong on this, but I don't think he knows that it died. It ran toward private, but he thinks it's still on public because they did go down and quarter it, get it hanging, get the head packed, you know, start packing stuff out and everything. Yeah. So I think at this time he still thinks shot on public, dies on public. But I think in the story does have that in his mind, like, whew, that was a close call. He was booking it towards that stretch private, of private.
Yeah.
Anyway, Outdoor Life films it. He writes about the hunt, the whole nine yards, right? Video comes out, and they had already had this interaction getting that first bull back from this guy. So I think the rancher had, like, interest in this story when
yeah.
it came
yeah,
out.
Yeah, he was keeping an eye out for it.
Yeah, he watches the video when it comes out. And recognizes a terrain feature in the video that is on his land. Turns out where Andrew shot the bull and where it ran to. No fences, no signage, no nothing. Pretty remote. Shot on private, dies on private. Is charged with trespassing after a long investigation and GPS coordinates, and yada, yada, yada. And again, kudos to him. He writes this article, comes out on Wednesday, last Wednesday. Cops to everything, says, yeah, man, you know, here's the deal. Here I am. I tried to do everything above board and, you know, do this kind of cool concept hunt, kill a bull in a landlocked parcel of BLM land. And here I am going to court, pleading guilty to trespassing. Didn't try to fight it. He said, I was absolutely wrong. With everything going on and just recently talking about retrieving animals off private land and everything, yeah. thought it'd be an interesting story to talk about. So
yeah,
that's what happened to my understanding.
Yeah. Well, and I've got to give him props for just being so honest about it. Like, and you even said like in the article, he went out with the game wardens, with the GPS.
Yep. Yep.
He took them to the exact location where he shot the animal, the route it ran, where it died. I mean, he was forthcoming on everything
yeah.
you could do. And he was like, let the investigation tell me what happened. And they let him know, yeah, you were really close to public, but you ended up just being a, you know, a hop, skip, and a jump into private.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you were on private in both cases. And he was like, all right, then I'm guilty.
Yeah.
And that's, you've got to give a guy like a handshake and say, man, salute him. Kudos yeah. for being that honest and trying not to weasel your way out of it. But I think it's awesome. I think it's also of the landowner
100%
being such a crotchety old
yeah
to where he's like, well, you were 3 feet in my property line, that's it, you're getting fined, you're gonna get arrested, you're gonna get this, that, and that, get
really bull, pressing the
get
issue,
get your bull taken away.
Yeah,
to me what it sounds like is the old fart was trying to maintain that landlocked BLM parcel as his private hunting little hole is what I'm thinking.
In the article they talk about it, that rancher sells hunts.
Exactly. So
on the property.
Yeah. And by buying his tag, you have access to all that BLM land that's landlocked.
Yes.
So when he found a loophole to charter a helicopter to get into the thousands upon thousands of acres of BLM land, the rancher didn't like it. And he was like, I am going to smoke this dude any way I can.
I agree with you 100%. Here's the thing, too, that the rancher had to know. I'm assuming at some point that it was he became aware, probably in the first interaction, stealing that bull, that it was a crew from Outdoor Life.
Right.
That this was going to be a story. And the rancher's probably going, man, once this gets out, you can do this. The golden goose has now been cooked and I'm screwed.
Yeah, because now every hunter's going to be chartering
or taking those ultralights or something in there. Yeah.
And now my honey holes are gone.
Yeah. This tag I normally sell for $10,000. Yeah. I'm lucky if I'm going to get five for it now.
Yeah, exactly. Because now he can't say, hey, it's not only my property, but since this is all
landlocked, access.
You have exclusive access and hunting rights to 10,000 acres of BLM that nobody else can get to because I own the land around it.
Yeah. And so over the break, we were talking about my daughter's antelope hunt. There's a herd of antelope that likes to hang out on some ag fields out there, and thought, no rancher would turn down a cute little girl with her first tag.
Shorter than ears antelope.
Yeah, but you never know. Yeah.
You never know, because there are a crazy amount of antelope in that area you guys are going. Yeah.
And I don't think it'll come to that. I think we got plenty of public land to hunt and everything, but... You know, some of this stuff, can you think of anything that is looked at, like, you know, in this story as like a gem of landlocked stuff in Nevada?
And Northern Washoe's, some parts in Northern Washoe.
The Jassics.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And part of Fox Mountain and stuff is all landlocked.
Okay, good point.
Yeah, getting up on top of there, and there's some big deer up there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so, and that's all landlocked.
That's right.
And then if this land exchange happens in eastern Nevada there,
the Wine Cup
Gambles Ranch, if that happens, holy geez, you're talking 100,000, 150, 200,000 acres of landlocked.
Yeah.
Some of the best elk hunting in the state will be landlocked.
Yeah.
If that goes through.
Where is that? They're being pretty hush-hush about it.
Yeah, that's kind of like on that east side of Jarbidge, all that area.
No. I know where it is. I mean, where does the transfer stand?
It's kind of at a standstill now because of, they're still trying to move forward. And they've been very open about, you know, it's going to be a working ranch, but we're also going to be a private hunting facility.
We have got to wrap up the show. We are out of here. Do not go anywhere. Stay tuned because Tom Gresham's Gun Talk is coming up next.